Welcome to Native America Calling. I'm Brett Mabee. Underfunded health systems and political marginalization amplify the devastation of COVID-19 infections among Native nations. That is among the conclusions in a paper released just as vaccinations were becoming widely available in the United States. Coming up this hour, we'll hear what effect systemic setbacks and other factors have on the health of Native people and get an update on how Native nations continue to respond. We're right back after the news.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. President Biden signed an executive order Monday to improve public safety and criminal justice for Native Americans and to address missing and murdered Indigenous people. The order seeks to build upon policies and work on coordination of federal law enforcement strategies to prevent and respond to violence. Biden signed the order at the White House Tribal Nations Summit in attendance with the First Lady, cabinet secretaries, and tribal leaders watching virtually.
Today, I'm directing federal officials to work with tribal nations on strategies to improve public safety and advance justice. This builds on the work we did together in reauthorizing the Violence Against Women Act in 2013, when we granted authority to tribes to exercise jurisdiction over non-Indian offenders who commit violence on tribal lands. We're going to reauthorize that again. We're going to expand the jurisdiction to include other offenses like sex trafficking, sexual assault, and child abuse.
The signing of the executive order was among five new initiatives Biden announced for Indian Country. The other initiatives involve protecting tribal treaty rights in the work of the federal government, increase tribal participation in the management of federal lands, incorporate tribal knowledge into the government's approach to fight climate change, and taking action to protect the Greater Chaco Canyon landscape in New Mexico from new oil and gas development. Also on Monday, President Biden signed the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, which includes more than $11 billion in investments for tribal communities. Tribal leaders took part in a policy panel on education and language during Monday's White House Tribal Nations Summit. Principal Chief of the Cherokee Nation, Chuck Hoskin Jr., talked about his tribe's investments in upgrading Head Start centers and expanding the Cherokee Language Immersion School. But he says one of the ways the administration can help is by creating a joint venture program at the Bureau of Indian Education to allow tribes to incur construction costs for upgrading BIE facilities.
We'll take resources committed by the federal government, but it'll also take trust in the tribes to know how to chart a destiny when it comes to education, including investing in capital improvements at our own schools. We can do it. We can do it better than anyone. We need the federal government to give us some additional flexibility. So that's one point on which I would challenge the administration to take a look at, see how we can be more flexible with our Bureau of Indian Education schools, particularly those that are operated by tribes, as is the case of the Cherokee Nation.
Hoskin also highlighted the tribe's effort to save the Cherokee language. The summit continues Tuesday. Tribal officials are sounding the alarm about climate change's disproportionate impacts on their communities, the Mountain West News Bureau's Robin Vincent reports.
Tribal leaders say the region's historic drought is wreaking havoc on the land and altering a way of life long centered on hunting and fishing. Jordan Dresser is chairman of the Northern Arapaho Tribe. He says short springs in Wyoming have led to longer wildfire seasons. But he sees some bright spots when it comes to tackling climate change.
It's pushing us to really tap into our Indigenous power and our Indigenous knowledge.
Dresser cited the tribe's buffalo herd. He says they recently birthed their first calf, and ensuring the herd's vitality is one way for the Northern Arapaho to become sustainable and reconnect to Native culture. Now tribal communities are anticipating billions in funding from the federal infrastructure bill. It includes money for climate adaptation and resilience, wildfire mitigation, and clean energy. I'm Robin Vincent.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by the Smithsonian's National Museum of the American Indian, presenting the annual Native Cinema Showcase. 47 films representing 39 Native nations in 13 countries, available from November 12th to the 18th on demand at americanindian.si.edu.
Support by the Center for Indigenous Cancer Research at Roswell Park Comprehensive Cancer Center, dedicated to cancer research, medicine, and cancer care for Indigenous population. A no-charge online risk assessment tool is available at roswellpark.org/assessme.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Native America Calling. Coming to you live from the Allegheny Territory of the Seneca Nation, I'm Brett Mabee. Many Native populations suffered more severe devastation from the COVID-19 pandemic than their non-Native counterparts. A new study by a team of researchers puts the blame for the added health threats and loss of life on decisions by outside political entities and leaders. Among the main factors is long-standing neglect by federal agencies that are not living up to the promises they are legally bound to uphold. That includes clinics and hospitals that are not fully funded and a lack of basic infrastructure and awareness. Those, combined with inadequate responses by neighboring governments to the largest health threat in recent memory, created an outsized threat to Native people. The good news is many Native leaders were able to regain control over the crisis. Today we'll get the details of that report by its authors. We'll also get an update from those who witnessed the pandemic on the ground. And as always, we want to hear from you as well. You're welcome to join us by calling 1-800-996-2848. That's 1-800-99-NATIVE. Joining us from Seattle, Washington, is Laura E. Evans. She's an associate professor at the University of Washington at the Evans School of Public Policy and Governance. Welcome to Native America Calling, Laura.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Thank you once again. And I guess to start off, let's get a little bit of background. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about what this research is.
Yeah, so this is a project with Dr. Carmela Rabal, who I think is also on the call, Raymond Foxworth from the First Nations Development Institute, Cheryl Ellenwood from Washington State University, and Gabriel Sanchez from the University of New Mexico. And I do want to stress it is equal work on this project. So we got started on trying to figure out what some of the initial data on COVID-19 cases indicated. Picking up in particular the crowdsourced data from Indian country today. And I think we have some important findings to say about what was driving COVID-19 cases on tribal lands, consistent with the patterns that you were describing.
Needless to say, it's an oversimplification to say that it happened now, but were there any surprises when you compiled the research?
Well, I think, there's always the question of all the multiple factors that could be driving national trends. What are the ones that really, really stand out? In our work, there were four that really stood out. First of all, we found more COVID-19 cases on tribal lands that were in Republican states. We found more COVID-19 cases on tribal lands where more households lack plumbing. More cases where households don't speak English, and more cases on tribal lands where more non-Native Americans travel onto those tribal lands.
So needless to say, a perfect storm of sorts.
That's exactly right.
In compiling this data, who did you talk with, and what factors went into your findings?
So the main data that we worked with was the crowdsourced data that Indian Country Today had gathered, asking lots of individuals to contribute information on COVID cases happening on the lands of both federally recognized tribes and state recognized tribes as well. And so to that, we brought to some other sources of data that tend to get used a lot in quantitative analysis, data collected by the Census Bureau about various demographic features, and then data about state-level political patterns.
Laura, I want to bring something back up before moving on to our next guest, or bringing our next guest onto the air as well. You mentioned that the COVID-19 transmission rates were higher in states that were more Republican-leaning. Why would decisions by Republican governors have any bearing on the health of those living on reservations in those states?
Well, I think we found, quite simply as a national pattern, that Republican governors in particular were less likely to provide support for the programs that were relevant to tribes and targeted to tribes. So, for example, when we think about non-Native Americans traveling onto tribal lands, you know, there's some prominent cases where Democratic governors were supportive of tribes imposing restrictions. In cases where Republican governors were not supportive of providing those protections. And so I think we saw a lot of reasons why in Republican states, there was essentially less awareness and less targeting of services to the needs of Native people.
Also joining us in our conversation today from Dublin, Ireland, or in Dublin, Ireland, is Dr. Camilla Robel. She's a visiting professor at the American University of Sovereign Nations, and she's Okewinge. Welcome to Native America Calling today, Carmela.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, I'm so glad we could get caught up. And it's my understanding, Dr. Robel, that you are also very key in how this report came about. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit from your perspective in how this all came together.
I think all of us as researchers are very concerned with this crisis and the way it's hitting tribal communities. And I think one really important contribution to this was policy recommendations. So not only do we capture these areas that are super significant, that are impacting, thought carefully through recommendations that we provided to state leaders, public health officials, in addressing the issues that happen. So, for example, you know, funding, providing for Native Nations to support their programs, their health program, and, you know, other items.
Dr. Roybal, sorry, we have a little bit of a hard time keeping the connection good. I'd imagine the distance has a lot to do with that. So I apologize if when I ask you a question, you already kind of answered it. Your tribe's ability to act on health threats independently from their neighboring state governments, did the tribe's ability to act help avoid greater numbers of infections?
Oh, definitely. The tribes that were able to close, you know, tribal borders, that were able to work with state governments in order to bring PPE or COVID testing, and those states that had support, you know, to maintain those closures without opposition, that helped. You know, that helped. That points to curb other areas around providing, you know, economic support or broadband, or allowing, or, you know, assisting tribes or to distribute material in appropriate languages and things like that.
In all of these decision-making processes, what decisions held the most threat?
Decisions. Laura, do you want to?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, we can think about some structural and long-term issues. So inadequate investment in infrastructure on tribal lands, and including inadequate investment in broadband services. I think also, as we think about some of the immediate failings that happened by state and federal agencies, was the lack of culturally appropriate health information, either appropriate to individuals who didn't have plumbing at home or individuals who preferred to speak a language other than English. So health information can't be one size fits all. It needs to be designed by states and federal agencies to meet the needs of Native communities.
In discussing the individualization of these policies, there are instances where, I don't want to say it is a one-size-fits-all, but in what unique ways did you find these challenges emerge from nation to nation?
So unique in terms of variation among tribes or tribes as compared to national and state patterns?
Among tribes, my apologies for not clarifying.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. So certainly as we look at differences between federally recognized tribes and state recognized tribes, there are a set of authorities and powers that federally recognized tribes have that state recognized tribes don't have. Those tribes can't put the particular demands on the federal government to meet those needs. I think also, you know, larger tribes are able to have a stronger voice in state capitals, although oftentimes there's plenty of ignoring those voices. But I do think it is hard for smaller tribes oftentimes to make their voices heard in a broader context. But that's not to suggest that anyone has an easy time engaging in that expression. But I think for small tribes, it can be much more challenging to get outside actors to notice the needs and concerns that they have.
Were there cultural factors that also played into some of the obstacles as well?
You know, I would say in terms of, you know, certainly if I were to look at any particular tribal government, I would say, of course, culture and social context matters. But I think also, you know, one of the things we're stressing is there are nationwide patterns and patterns across states. So you worry about some policymakers saying, oh, it's too complicated. You know, we'd have to have a policy for each individual tribe. And, you know, we would, you know, if that's a stereotype, we would still push back against that kind of characterization that.
Laura, we'll pick up the conversation right after the break. Do you have a comment or question for today's show? You're welcome to call in to 1-800-996-2848. That's 1-800-99-NATIVE.
Tune in right here every weekday to hear the only national call-in radio show from a Native American viewpoint. We explore topics that range from traditional cultural practices to up-to-the-minute news that affects every American. We hope you join us for the next Native America Calling.
I feel happier when my children and grandchildren spend time with me or someone comes to visit. We also need to stay active to keep our spirits alive. As elders, our teachings are needed more than ever. The more we're socially connected with family and community, the less health problems we'll have, the longer we'll live. Remember, you're not alone. Connected together, we'll stand strong. More on elder isolation and caregiver resources at connectedindigenouselders.org. The National Indian Council on Aging supports this show.
You're listening to Native America Calling. I'm Brett Mabee. What are the factors you see contributing to the disproportionate size of the COVID-19 crisis on Native nations, especially during the start of the pandemic? We're hearing an academic analysis of that crisis, and we're about to get another view from the ground level. We want to hear from you as well. What are your thoughts? Join us by calling 1-800-996-2848. That's 1-800-99-NATIVE. I wanted to bring Carmela back on before introducing our next two guests as well, especially since I think we're able to get a little bit of the technical bubbles out of the way anyway. Dr. Carmela Roybal, welcome back to Native America Calling. I did want to discuss a little bit more on your participation and some of your findings, as you were one of the key authors of this study as well.
Thank you. Hopefully, this connection is a little bit better.
Sound pretty good.
Great. So some of the, thinking through key findings and the policy pieces that I think were really important to this project, I think parts that I would just really want to add is thinking through, what needs to be done now as far as long-term recovery looks like. And this is addressed in the article, in this research and other research that we have that's up and coming. But thinking through, vital areas that are impacting tribes, like broadband services, investment, again, in infrastructure, also investment in education. So we talk a little bit about this in the article, but we're looking at some of those gaps that this pandemic is going to cause in, educational attainment and what the long-term effects. Also thinking forward, looking at how we can think through support, how this is, the support that's needed to moving forward to give tribes, to give nations the support that they need. I'm trying to think through, Laura, if there's anything else. I know we discussed, our findings and...
Dr. Rubin, yeah, one thing I would...
Oh, no, sorry about that, Laura. Go ahead.
Yes, Dr. Roybal's absolutely correct. One thing I might add is, I think the pandemic has highlighted tribes' needs for more unrestricted funds from federal agencies, as opposed to, these dollars have to be spent on X, these dollars have to be spent on Y. There's been a strong need to very quickly reallocate money to serve emerging needs. I think it's very helpful if federal funding, looking forward, is more designed around unrestricted funds so that tribes have that flexibility to respond to their immediate and emerging needs.
I certainly hope to discuss more of the long-term recovery goals throughout the remainder of our conversation. I do want to get another perspective, this time from the ground level and from one of the most publicized COVID-19 cases around the United States. And of course, I'm talking about the Navajo Nation. At this time, I want to bring on our next guest. Joining us from the Navajo Nation is Nathaniel Brown. He's a delegate for the Navajo Nation Council, and he is Navajo. Welcome to Native America Calling today, Delegate Brown.
Yeah, Ben, good afternoon. Or actually, it is almost noon. Hello, everyone. Native America Calling. Hello.
I'm grateful that you could join us on the line today. And Delegate Brown, I guess my questions revolve specifically around the status of COVID infections right now on the Navajo Nation. What can you update us on?
Yes, thank you for this question. Currently, the Navajo Nation, the latest update as far as the number of people Navajo people that we have lost to this pandemic. We've lost over 1,500 people to COVID. And there are over 36,000 of our people who tested positive and who recovered. So we are still battling with this new variant, the Delta variant. And the federal dollars do help, but I think what I know is our Diné teachings have really helped us a lot also. And really the big question also on Navajo was, what is this here to teach us? What is this pandemic here to teach us as a whole? What is Mother Earth trying to tell us? What is nature trying to tell us? So it's really taking us back into nature. So it's teaching us that we as Native Americans already have a lot of the medicine, a lot of herbal medicine. We have our hatahis. We have, again, traditional herbal medicine that also have been helping us. And then the real teaching also is, what is it here to teach us? I've had elders tell me, this is a wake-up call for all of us as as Indigenous people that we are losing our language, we're losing our way of life, and this is a wake-up call to all of us, not just as Navajo people, but as Indigenous people who are here to speak for Mother Earth and nature. So that's, but we're still battling. We have, we're happy with the vaccination rate, but we're also respectful for our people who choose not to get vaccinated. So, but the good news is, you know, the death rate has gone down tremendously from day to day, but we are still combating with our people who have the lack of basic infrastructure like water, power, and housing.
So again, we see this theme of the elements, or the wrong elements in this case, all coming together to create this perfect storm. In your experience, what systems have worked for the Navajo Nation? What hasn't worked so far?
Yes, what has worked is the amazing thing that I found was, you know, there's not just in leadership, but our people, and including other tribes and our allies who have activated the volunteerism. And this is, you know, people really, as we say, and that people really went down to kinship and to the grassroots level, who reached out to Navajo Nation and our people, bringing at the beginning when there was a lot of unknowns, when there was a lot of we don't know what this is capable of, how it's traveling. We know the basics, but in the midst of all of that, our people, you know, from Salt Lake City, Utah, and the surrounding, and Phoenix, and Albuquerque, and all over the United States and across the globe, people have been donating sanitizers. As you're aware, you know, on Navajo, even where I live in Dunahoso, in Kayenta, we have to travel about 2 hours either way to get, and by the time our people get to stores, you know, all the sanitizers, everything was sold out. People have to spend the night before, travel really, really early to get basics too, and including like vitamin C, zinc, stuff like that. So that, I would say, has worked. And now we have learned from it, our chapters. And also our chapter leadership has really stepped up and traveling in their own vehicles, just going all over the place. And then the delivery system in a lot of places, I can speak for my communities of Chilchimbito, Dunahoso, and Kayenta, where, you know, our volunteers were doing no contact delivery, no contact pickup. And really that restored so much hope in a lot of us. So that, and what hasn't really helped is the frustration with sometimes our Navajo leadership, even as myself, you know, a lot of it was stored centrally in Chinle, and our people didn't have access to it. And also, you know, lessons learned, and, you know, Navajo Nation President and 24th Navajo Nation Council, it took us a while to actually start using the funds. It took over 5 months. So that was a really disturbing, but we've learned from that. And with the ARPA funds, we are moving forward now and really strategically moving. So that's the lessons learned and looking in hindsight. Yes.
Delegate Brown, once this became apparent that this was very much a real thing, the Navajo Nation went into quick, tight, strict procedures, quite a bit stricter, in fact, than the state of Arizona's. Are there things that the state could have done to have helped the Navajo Nation deal with the pandemic better?
Yes. One of the things that from the very beginning that we've asked the state was to close down the state highways. We wanted to close off any type of contact, anyone traveling back and forth. But what I noticed the first couple of weeks when the shutdowns happened on the Navajo Nation and around us was we still had a lot of outsiders driving through the nation. And that was one big reason why we know that people were still traveling through the nation, looking for bathroom, restaurants to eat at. And so there was still that. And then after about maybe 3 months, our people started traveling. You know, of course, our essential workers were the only people allowed to travel to grocery stores. And then, of course, grocery stores were not closed. IHS, you know, did a really good job. I think that they did a really good job in closing down and really focusing on helping our people. And of course, it wasn't perfect. Again, you know, this is for a lot of us, this is our first pandemic. And it was really, really scary to the point where we were constantly on our conference call as 24th Navajo Nation Council and our incident command, our emergency management system, our police, IHS. And we turned about every rock over trying to understand and getting the education. So we learned a lot and we're continuing to learn, right? So just a state that I wish that's what we really push for. And that seems as a sovereign nation, that's something I think that as indigenous America, that we need to look at those systems and how we can protect our people in the future, how to keep our people safe. Thank you.
These certainly are unprecedented times for all of us, and I think you hit the nail right on the head with that. Do you have a comment or question for today's show? You're welcome to call in at 1-800-996-2848. You can also email us at comments@nativeamericacalling.com. Joining us now is Carl Little Owl. He served as the public health officer for the Crow Tribe in 2020 during the height of the COVID-19 pandemic. He is Crow. Welcome to Native America Calling, Carl.
Good afternoon, Brent. I'm glad to be on the show. Thank you for the invitation to be part of today's conversation.
As we were mentioning, clearly most of the national headlines seem to kind of center around the efforts and the situation that was going on with the Navajo people. However, as we're all well aware, this has affected us all in various ways. And in fact, that's kind of the point of what this study is that we're talking about. And I wanted to get your perspective right now. The Crow Nation experienced a spike in cases as recently as last month, prompting new safety measures. What are some of the factors that contributed to those measures?
I think a lot of the Crow Reservation, you know, we're kind of in a very unique situation, unique location, I guess, and a lot of the factors that the author of the study that we're discussing, you know, a lot of it is true, you know, and, you know, the Crow Nation, right, dealing with multi-jurisdictions, you know, and, you know, we have a major interstate corridor that goes right in the heart of our nation. And, you know, that made it just as challenging trying to, you know, cut the numbers down. And then our neighboring county, Yellowstone County, is the largest populated area in the state of Montana, and they're our neighbor. So, you know, the Crow people are facing with a lot in regards to trying to get a handle on our numbers.
Carl, you mentioned something that has been brought up a lot today, these roads that travel through the territories. And that could be the topic for a whole other show, I think. But what my question is for you right now, when you see people traveling in and about, and I could ask this question to anybody who's joining us today, but were you finding that people were intentionally being flippant about some of the regulations as they were traveling through, or was there more or less at least attempts at being courteous?
Well, last year at the beginning of the pandemic in 2020, when Yellowstone County first had their numbers, that was a trigger for us to begin to, you know, initiating some stricter measures. We initiated some road closures and safety checkpoints, as we called them. And, you know, that had a ripple effect at the local level because, you know, you had, you know, non-natives that felt they didn't have to respect tribal law. And then, you know, that put a lot of pressure on the state government in regards to, you know, whether they wanted to support the tribe with some of our decisions or not, because, you know, we are a tourist state. And, you know, tourism is a major industry in Montana, and it brings in a lot of revenue. So, you know, and it was a political year as well. And, you know, so we're facing facing that. But in regards to the us as a tribe, you know, our position was, you know, this is our homeland. These are our elders. These are our families and communities, and we're going to have to do what we need to do to protect them. So we stood our ground, and, you know, we were fortunate that the state eventually supported us and backed us in regards to our safety checkpoints. And that made a big difference in regards to decreasing the flow of outside traffic coming in. And then also we were able to, you know, keep a handle on who was going leaving the reservation.
I imagine that it was a pretty frustrating. Laura, Carmela, well, just very briefly, I want to ask about outside visitors to the res. You were finding these similar kinds of situations arise everywhere, yeah?
So I'll go ahead and hop in. Yes, I think that was a pattern that persisted everywhere. I think it was also an issue for tribes with more checkerboarded lands. And so larger number of individuals who are not Native American, who are living within the borders of a Native nation, then, you know, going to gas stations, shopping in local areas, and being not subject to the civil regulatory powers of tribal governments.
We have a lot more to talk about while we have the time today. You're listening to Native America Calling. We'd love to hear from you. Call in at 1-800-996-2848. You can also reach out on Facebook at Native America Calling or on Twitter at 1-800-99-NATIVE. We have to take a short break. We'll be right back.
Life's an adventure, but your health shouldn't be. Check out open enrollment option November 1 through January 15. Contact your local Indian healthcare provider for more information. Visit healthcare.gov or call 1-800-318-2596. Message from Center for Medicare Medicaid Service.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Brett Mabee. There's still time to get in on our discussion about what fueled the outsized rate of COVID-19 infections for Native Americans. You're welcome to join us by calling 1-800-996-2848. That's 1-800-99-NATIVE. In fact, we're going to go to the lines right now. Calling and joining us from Albuquerque, New Mexico, listening in on KUNM. I'd like to welcome Akimi to the show. Welcome to Native America Calling today.
Hello, good afternoon, or good morning.
Good morning and afternoon, depending on where you're joining us from. Go ahead. The discussion is now yours, or the microphone is yours. You have some thoughts on our discussion today.
Thank you. Yes, I just wanted to make a comment. I'm calling from Albuquerque, New Mexico, and I'm a part of the Diné Nation, Navajo Nation Reservation, and we have several surrounding pueblos from here to where I'm from, Gallup area, and I think that a lot of the pueblos, and including the Navajo Nation, you know, they really did a great job at having checkpoints and screening individuals who are coming through the different reservations. However, as a person pointed out earlier, that there was still a lot of foot traffic going through, and it really made me think of something one of the leaders from, or individuals from our community, his name is Albert Hale, and about 10 or 15 years ago, and maybe even before that, he had suggested that we get toll fees on the Navajo Nation, and I think that that would have been a great way to exercise our sovereignty, but also, you know, identify our nation's boundaries, whether you're just driving through or you're a tourist actually visiting for the cultural sites. I think that's something that we need to think about together as Native peoples. You know, we're there to, we created these checkpoints and boundaries to protect our people during the pandemic. However, going forward, as an act of sovereignty, I think that we should also consider toll fees, because when we travel around to other states and to other parts of this country that, you know, have been using toll fees this whole time, there's nothing in that in that respect as, you know, giving away any power or anything to these states. It's just something that people are used to. And I think if we instill that type of thing going forward, you know, hopefully we don't experience another pandemic in our lifetime, but for future generations, I think that that would be a great way to not only establish immediate checkpoints in the face of natural disasters, but also just to put a step forward for our sovereignty. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much. And Akemi, I'd like to follow up with that by saying, yeah, you could feed two birds with one corn, theoretically, with that. Not only can you help to slow some of the traffic coming through, you can help raise funds to offset the costs of maintaining expensive highways and whatnot as well. Before we bring our next caller on, I do want to quickly throw this back to Council Delegate Brown. Has anything like this ever come up in the conversation, this idea of tolls or other ways to help kind of curb some of this?
Yes, thank you, Britt. That is always a big topic of discussion with Navajo Nation leadership. And specifically, you know, during the pandemic and then before the pandemic, you know, the Kayenta Middle School, actually the elementary school students, the second graders, sent me a bunch of letters requesting that uranium not be transported through the Navajo Nation, that would go directly by their school. So we have met as council, and what we learn is these highways are state highways, and they're funded by state dollars. And then going a little bit back, what we have done as Navajo Nation, specifically in Western Agency, is within Arizona, we requested some of these privilege tax. the nation currently, we do not receive about, just Navajo alone puts in about $25 million on average, about $20 to $25 million every year. That's just Navajo dollars. That's not including other tribes. But yet, do we see any of that back on the nation? No, we don't. Again, the it's a state road. And that's the most ironic thing is these state roads that go through the Navajo Nation, like Highway 160, we do not have control over that. So those are something that we are consistently looking at. And again, the end is it's the dollars. Who's paying for the road and maintaining the road? And it's ADOT, Arizona Department of Transportation. And I would imagine within the state of Arizona and New Mexico, I mean, Utah and New Mexico is the same as well. So yes, but we'll continue to look at that and meet with state leadership on this. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your insights. Also joining us on the line, former tribal chair of the Oglala Sioux, he had troubles with Governor Kristi Noem. Listening in on Keeley Radio from Pine Ridge, South Dakota, welcome, Julian, to the show today. You're on Native America Calling.
Good afternoon. Thank you for this time and for this discussion. My name is Julian Bearrunner. I currently was serving as the 43rd president of the Oglala Sioux Tribe, the second youngest chairman ever to hold that seat. And like, you know, the discussion led earlier, you know, this was unprecedented times. And being a young chairman myself, you know, in the face of a pandemic, I was really, you know, hoping for, you know, a better direction from our state and national leaders. However, it was it was complete opposite. You know, immediately I gathered my spiritual leaders, I gathered my medicine people, and I brought them together and I asked them, you know, for their guidance and from, you know, their beliefs and their power and their connection to the spirit world to help to guide us, to lead us through this time. Like, our way of life has always led us through every hardship, whether it was man-made or natural. So, you know, my spiritual leaders, they did come together, and I'm very thankful for them. You know, we quickly established a task force with public officials within the Oglala Sioux Tribe, such as my health administrator. All of my tribal programs came together, the Department of Public Safety, our emergency medical services, our emergency management, some of our council delegation. They all came to the table and helped to establish some of the things that were beginning of the pandemic. Now, I never was ever invited or had a sit down with our state governor, Kristi Noem. However, the first, you know, contact after the pandemic was, you know, her question wasn't how we were doing or what they can do to help, but it was, why do you have checkpoints up on your reservation? So, you know, that there was a decision amongst the spiritual leaders and our grassroots people to establish these checkpoints to help to slow the pandemic, which is something that, you know, I felt and totally agreed with. So we authorized that, but we also ensured that our border checkpoints were well within the boundaries of the IRA government or, you know, or the reservation line. And however, so, you know, when the governor's secretary of tribal relations, Mr. Flute, reached out to me with the Department of Public Safety, the South Dakota Department of Transportation, and, you know, other officials, as well as the attorney general's office, you know, that was their main concern was the checkpoints, you know, but I assured them that these checkpoints were well within the governance of the Oglala Sioux tribe, well within our boundaries, and that we were going to, you know, stand firm on our sovereignty and our checkpoints were going to remain, you know, and we do have one major state highway, which is Highway 18 that runs through the reservation, you know, which was a critical point. However, my grassroots were ready to stake down and, you know, and bear arms if they needed to protect, you know, to help to do their part to protect the people. And a lot of us, you know, as well as my executive board, you know, we all went out and we stood and we showed support and solidarity with our grassroots, with our people, you know, and helping them to engage, to help to defend, you know, what was ours. And like we said, you know, I had no idea, you know, what to do in a pandemic, you know? So my biggest thing was to revert back to our way of life, but also to bring in those professionals and experts from our healthcare department.
Thank you so much for your comments, Chairman Bear Runner. It's amazing to me to see these grassroots efforts being combined with the other modes of leadership and the other systems already in place. And we've heard that a few times throughout our conversation. And I want to throw this next question back and bring back Cara Little Owl at this time. I was wondering if you saw any kind of mobilization, quick mobilization like that on a grassroots level, because for a long time, there has been, I guess, a little bit of an expectancy to rely on elected leaders to get everything done. But as cases like this show, that is not always feasible to do. Yeah.
At the beginning of the pandemic, you know, our chairman at the time declared a state of emergency, and we activated our incident command team, you know, consisting of various, you know, folks that have experience dealing with any type of emergency. And as you know, dealing with a pandemic was of this nature was new to us, but we wanted to make sure we had joint coordination with the tribe, with the state, with the county, and with the federal entities. But one thing that we really wanted to make clear is, you know, the tribe's going to take the lead. You know, we know our people, we know our community, we speak our language, we understand our needs. And that was one thing that we wanted to send a message to our partners, was that, you know, the Crow tribe is going to take the lead in our COVID response. And, you know, I think we sent a strong message on how quickly we are able to mobilize and bring folks to the table and come up with a plan that, you know, how we're going to handle this emergency.
How well did that message sit with the elected leaders of the state of Montana?
You know, it was kind of on a fence for the state. You know, like I said, last year was a election year for our governor. He was a Democratic governor, and he was, you know, pressured with, you know, with the tourist industry. You know, Bighorn River flows right through, you know, the Crow Reservation. That's a major fishery in the state of Montana, well, United States. So that draws in a lot of, you know, revenue dollars for the area. And so the governor was in a tight, in a dilemma of, do I support the tribes or do I support this major industry that supports the state? But I think how quickly we were mobilized and how firm we were, you know, he realized he had to back up the state. I mean, back up the tribe. So he supported, you know, a lot of our initiatives. But I know he was under a lot of pressure, and I think that had some influence on him not being reelected, though.
Did that relationship after the election cycle, did it get better or did it get worse?
Actually, it was better because, you know, in the long run, the tribal government was respected, you know, and the federal government sent a team from the Center of Disease Control, as we requested, and working with the Indian Health Services, you know, they all knew that they had to respect our sovereignty and our direction and leadership. So, you know, they provided the advice and guidance, and, you know, we came up with a plan to how we're going to tackle our this pandemic.
Thank you so much for your insights, Carl. One last question. What are some of the effective measures that you witnessed as a health official during this trying time?
I think one of the things that we dealt with was a major communication barrier. You know, where I tried that, you know, a lot of our members still speak the language. I'm 41 years old, and my English is my second language, so I'm very blessed in nature. So we have a good percentage of the tribal membership that still speaks the language. So, you know, in regards to health education and, you know, educating our tribal members on what this pandemic is, a lot of them didn't know what contact tracing was or quarantining was or, you know, the various language that's being used during this time. So we had to work with our health partners and come up with a education plan on how we're going to go out and, you know, provide awareness to our people and knowing that there's going to be a language barrier and culture barrier. And, you know, we really had to work hand in hand with our other health partners.
Thank you so much once again, Carl. I do want to just bring it back to Dr. Carmela Roybal one more time. I guess pretty much this confirms what your study showed, yeah?
Definitely. There's a couple points that, looking forward, right, long term, I guess that's kind of where I want to just take this and kind of leaving more food for thought, but really thinking through these long-term effects. So many of our tribes, if we're looking at health data, we're seeing increased death to, you know, other causes. We're seeing increased suicide. We're seeing increased opiate-related deaths. We're seeing increased alcohol-related deaths. We're seeing numbers in children that aren't reported. We're seeing domestic violence, MMIW cases going up. And so there's a lot of work to be done. And, you know, COVID has exacerbated many of these items. And so just thinking through and, you know, moving forward with our tribes, you know, how we can, like, work together in solidarity to kind of think through ways in order to, you know, shift this narrative and just keep moving forward in a healthy way.
Dr. Roybal, I certainly hope we can have future discussions on what tribes can do with this information, how we can move forward and continue to look over the horizon for some of these complicated scenarios that we find ourselves in as well. It's amazing to me to see things go back to a grassroots level. And one of the other themes that continues to come up in these recent conversations, whether we're talking about education, revitalization, or COVID response, is how much the cultures of Indigenous nations come back into the foreplay, again, in my mind, reemphasizing the need to keep the languages very much alive, to keep all of this very much alive, so we can move forward. That's all the time we have for our show today. I want to thank my guest, Navajo Nation Chairman Council Person Brown, also Carl Little Owl, Carmela Roybal, and Laura E. Evans. We have another live show for you tomorrow. Host Tara Gatewood talks to those behind a series of books.
Arlantimikun Piranialu, Indorlaminartusi, November 1, January 15, Watartilu, Rula Louis, Indian Healthcare Provided Koyan, Kaisakangwasi, Turuminasi, Healthcare.gov, Nakakilalu, 1-800-318-2596. Unakailuni, Center for Medicare, Medicaid Service Kunin.
Support by VisionMaker Media, presenting Community, Returning Home Through Togetherness, an online event and panel discussion commemorating Native Americans and Alaska Native veterans. Available for streaming 24/7, November 1st through the 24th. Native Americans and Alaska Natives are one of the most consistent demographics that risk their lives for a government that tried to eradicate them. Returning Home Through Togetherness is open to the public for online streaming with no charge at visionmakermedia.org as part of VisionMaker Media's 45th anniversary.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service. Music is by Brent Michael Davis. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.